Have you ever recorded and then realized it wasn't recording or anything like that? Any major tech issues?
I don't think we've ever had anything like that, no.
Okay, that's good. It won't happen now.
I'm going to put shoes on, I think.
Okay.
No, you're not wearing shoes. I'm fine. Cool.
Can you see my feet in it?
No, you can't see your feet in it.
I was like, I'm definitely putting on shoes. These are not cute, but I mean, maybe you have some feet fetish.
Yeah, I know, to our followers, I'm getting to see Robbie's feet for free right now. They're very...
Yeah, describe them toe by toe.
Yeah, I spend the rest of the podcast just like really deeply describing your feet. Should we get this podcast started?
Yeah, let's do it.
Welcome to the Rainbow Room,
our podcast about writing, representation,
and gay stuff.
This is season 4, episode 31, The Sky Blues.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Rainbow Room. I'm Andrew Steyer, and today I'm here with my guest, Robbie Couch.
Hello. Excited to be here.
We're so excited to have you, man. Man, I'm still saying we. Oh, I miss Eric. I'm so excited to have you, man. Thank you so much for doing this. This is really cool.
Yeah.
So we are here to talk about, well, we'll talk a little bit probably about all of Robbie's projects, but specifically The Sky Blues by Robbie Couch, with Robbie Couch. And one of the reasons I wanted to discuss this book is it is being made into a movie, which I think is really, really cool.
Yeah.
So let's start by what details do you want to share with our audience? Introduce yourself.
Yeah. So I'm Robbie Couch, a YA author. I write queer YA books. And The Sky Blues was my first book that came out, which was 2000 or 2021. Which is wild to think about because it feels like a different, like a lifetime ago at this point. But my fourth book just came out a few weeks ago. Sky always has a very special place in my heart. And The Sky Blues is, takes place in Michigan. I'm originally from Michigan. It follows a gay, teenager, named Sky Baker, whose promposal plans go absolutely off the rails bad, because his promposal ideas get hacked and shared throughout the whole school in a really homophobic, terrible way. So he sort of is on a mission to find out who did it and, you know, if he wants to get revenge. And it's probably the most autobiographical-ish book that I've written. And it really has a special place in my heart. So, yeah.
Really? It's somewhat autobiographical. That's really cool.
In the sense that I would say it's the most of my four, in the sense that it, it takes place in small town, rural Michigan, very similar environment to where I grew up.
Is it the same city that you're from?
No, it's actually a fictional town.
Right? Okay.
It's
okay.
Completely fictional. Yeah. I would hold up my hand, but we're on a pod. Oh, but I guess it's on video. So yeah. So Michigan looks like this. I'm usually from, or I'm here, like Clio is my hometown over here. And the fictional Rockledge, Michigan is over here. And the UPS man is watching me do this. it's a big place. But it was definitely inspired by where I grew up. And a lot of the characters that I created there were kind of informed by that world and a lot of the people I came across in Michigan. So that's why it's autobiographical-ish. But Sky is very much different than me in many ways, and his upbringing is as well. So, yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm glad to hear you that, because his upbringing certainly has some rough times. Yeah. Also, just quick fun note. My parents are from Michigan, and I go there every winter. Yeah, my granddad lives in St. Clair.
Oh, so nice. If you know where
that is. Yeah.
Yeah, St. Clair, I think, is over here. Right? Do you know geography?
I'm not too familiar. No, I do know that people point to their hand, though. Like, seeing you do that, I'm like, all right, we're talking to a true Michigander here.
Absolutely, so, yes. Yeah. Which is like, I didn't even realize that was a weird thing until I moved out of Michigan, and then doing this to people, they're like, what the hell are you doing now? So, yeah, it's a little weird, but it's convenient, though.
Yeah, pointing to your hand like a mitten, right?
Right.
Also, four books, yeah. You just said that casually. Yeah, quick brag. Robbie has four books. That's amazing. Congratulations on your recent release.
Thank you.
What do you want to tease about that?
About book four?
Yeah.
Another First Chance is probably my most ambitious book, which freaks me out, but so far the reviews have been pretty positive, so that's good. Another First Chance is sort of a step in the more speculative direction, so like sci-fi light, I would say, but still based in a contemporary world, and it's queer YA. It follows a queer 18-year-old named River, who, right when you meet him at the beginning of the book, he's mourning the loss of his best friend Dylan, who died exactly a year ago to the day that the book starts. And he's grieving, he's really still upset and not really like processing it. And he enters the Affinity Trials, or gets blackmailed into the Affinity Trials, which is a social science experiment happening at his high school over summer break for teens who are struggling socially. And then once he's there, he starts to realize that his feelings for Dylan may have gone beyond friendship. And he also starts to suspect the researchers are up to some nefarious stuff that they're not being transparent about. So, yeah.
Oh, I love that. That sounds so juicy. Yeah. And I also got chills just when you said his feelings for his friend may have been more than just friendship. I mean, even you just delivering that, it's like, oh, man. Like,
oh, good. Okay.
Yeah.
That's a good sign.
It's so emotional. Yeah. It's so how beautiful and sad to realize important feelings for someone after they've passed. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, it's the book was sort of inspired by so grief is a really big theme of the book. Obviously, River's mourning Dylan. But the book was initially inspired by sort of a different form of grief, in that I was thinking about kind of my closeted self in high school and not being able to truly like be myself as a teenager in school, and kind of like grieving like that version of me when I was a kid. And that kind of got, you know, the creative juices flowing. And so it's sort of like a missed opportunity, or like a, you know, if I could go back, I would do it differently sort of, form of grief in that way. And I should also note the book is dual POV. So about a fifth of the chapters, not 50-50, but like a fifth of the chapters are through Dylan's perspective, the best friend that died from the day he died. So you go back to that day.
And yeah.
So I love these reactions. You're so big.
No, these are my sincere gut reactions. That's really cool.
Yeah.
It's also cool, like, I haven't heard the term dual POV. You know, I'm not as much in the author world as you are.
Sorry.
So I know what it means when you say it, but I'm like, oh, how cool. There's a term for it. Yeah. You were also explaining to me what speculative means. In case our audience doesn't know, can you explain what that means to me?
For sure. Yeah. And please like call me out if I ever am saying like weird terms, because I think sometimes I think everyone works in publishing. It's like, no. So speculative, my definition, which is probably, you know, you ask different authors, you probably get slight variations of it, but speculative, it's sort of like sci-fi light, I would say, where it's usually grounded in the contemporary world, or at least like a realistic version of the world. But then there's more, kind of a subtle, it doesn't have to be subtle, but sort of a, peppering, I would say, of like sci-fi-ness or like surrealism in the story.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not full blown, you know, like aliens and spaceships. And 'cause I think sometimes when you say sci-fi, readers kind of jump to the more extreme like versions of sci-fi. And so I feel like it's even more of like a marketing thing where they want to avoid that if it's still like grounded in a mostly contemporary world, which is sort of where my books fall. So.
Okay.
And speculative is really also general. It's a general term. So you'll hear it kind of tossed around for a lot of different stories. So. But yeah, I would say speculative.
As someone being marketed to, I don't think I would hear speculative and have any idea that that means it's sci-fi light. So I like your version. I like sci-fi light better, but it's good to know what that means. Yeah. So we have a segment on this podcast that I didn't warn you about. Although if you've heard previous episodes, you may have come across it. We don't always do it. But you're openly gay, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool. Also, anything I say that you want edited out, we can edit out. So I'm going to speak pretty freely. You can own it. So you're openly gay. We have a segment. What's the gayest thing you did this week?
Oh my God. You're asking after Pride weekend? Come on.
Yeah. If you already have your answer, let me know. But if not, I can try and go first.
The gayest thing I did this week. Yeah. Go for it.
Yeah. Think on it for so, for me, I went to, have you heard of Hard Candy?
Oh yeah, for sure.
Okay. You've heard of it. I hadn't heard of it before.
Yeah.
But this is my first.
It's the party?
Yeah. My first LA Pride. It was a party at a venue called Catch One. Now, the thing that's wild is it was $100 with a $20 service fee. So I paid $124 for this party. And the only reason I did it is, one, I had friends going, and two, I was like, well, this is my first LA Pride, I might as well like dive full in and like experience everything there is to experience. And it was a great party. I don't for $100 you can go to Disney World and some stuff. Like, I don't know. Like, right, there's a lot you can do with that for one night. But
It's wild. These Pride, there's a lot of like Pride parties and events that charge crazy.
Yeah, and they're getting away with it. And one, the demand is high, but two, I think it's almost by design because I think what's happening is, I have a whole theory about this, right? But like, I feel like a lot of what happens is the gay clubs get like gentrified, for lack of a better term, by straight people, like where straight people start going to them because they're fun, the music's good, whatever. And then now you don't necessarily have a gay space anymore. So now you have these they're like very underground parties. You go, they won't even send you the address unless you have a ticket. Yeah. And then they're super expensive. It's like, there are so many barriers to entry. You really gotta want to be in a gay space to be there. Right. So
there's probably truth in that. Yeah.
No, I think it's a big part of it. I also think, you know, there's people, taking advantage of the fact that gay men have disposable income. So they're getting away with these prices. But
yeah, I'm sure it's a little bit of both. No, I do feel like I had a similar conversation with a friend about cruising, because there's kind of been like, there's more like apps for cruising and stuff with gay and queer men. And it's funny because it's like, in 2024, there's like more opportunities than ever to like meet other queer people, which is not to minimize like the amount of homophobia and transphobia that exists everywhere. There still is a lot of it. But there's sort of a resurgence of that kind of like gritty, like underground, you know what I mean? Like, have you heard of Sniffies? I don't know. What is the like age appropriateness of this podcast? Like,
yeah, we are entering into a territory we don't always go into.
I'm not going into detail about
Sniffies. Well, it's just so funny because like your book is so innocent. And now we're talking about Sniffies.
That is one misconception, is just because you write YA doesn't mean you are.
Your life isn't YA. Yeah, exactly. You don't still act like a high school boy.
I don't, thank God. Yeah, but I do think there is some like, there is, that rings true to me, that there's sort of like a pull towards like, off the mainstream queerness, because queerness has kind of become commercialized, you know?
Yeah.
A bit more like, especially Pride. I shouldn't say queerness has become commercialized. Pride has been like commodified in many ways. So, but anyways, I digress. Sorry, your neighbor was just
funny. Are you eye-catching? People are like, who's this attractive man in Andrew's apartment?
Hopefully that's what they're thinking.
But. Yeah. We're recording in the studio, which is my bedroom. So one day when this podcast is famous, I'll be upgraded, and you're helping me get there. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah. No. So what's the gayest thing you did this week?
Oh, sorry. Yeah. The gayest thing I did this week. I guess probably the parade. I was in the Pride parade on Saturday.
Oh yeah. You told me you were in the parade. That's so cool.
I marched in it, and it wasn't like there was a rabbit couch float, to be clear, but I was marching with Alstora, which is a really great queer independent bookstore here in Los Angeles, and I have a few friends that run Alstora, and they do a rainbow book bus, which travels the country getting queer lit in front of people, especially younger readers and kids. So we marched alongside the Rainbow Book Bus. It was really fun.
That's so cool. So were there a bunch of other queer authors then?
Yeah, there was, there was a big group of people, and I'm sure there were authors that I didn't know were authors in there too. So yeah, there was a handful of other.
Name drop.
I was with Zach Sergi and Hannah Sawyer, Eric Cervini, runs Alstora, and he is a gay historian who has a really great book on queer history. So yeah, there's a handful of authors. Yeah.
That's really, really cool. Yeah, and it was fun.
Yeah. Great time.
And
great
very,
time.
And you felt very gay.
I felt very gay. Lots of rainbow, lots of queerness. Yeah. It was a good time. Cause sometimes parades can be just really overstimulation. So many people. It was definitely a lot of people, but it was like a good, the way it was like organized in the space, I felt okay. I felt safe. So it was good.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, before we go read the book, let's talk about the context of when this book came out.
Okay.
So this book came out in 2021, you said, which is only 3 years ago.
Right.
Which is really, really wild. And what was the landscape of media like in 2021? What made you be like, oh, we need a, a book like this?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's wild to think about now because I started writing it, even though it came out in 21, I started writing it and coming up with the idea of it in 2016, which was the year of the Trump election. And even though this book isn't like explicitly, political, I mean, it is and it isn't, right? Like it is in the sense that like queer identities are often weaponized and politicized. But there's no like overt politics on the page. But I was really inspired by, I think, just especially the young people standing up to a lot of the hate and bigotry that we were seeing during the campaign, back in 2015, 2016. And, I really wanted to write a book. I always wanted to write a book, but, the idea for the story came to me and I really wanted to center a young queer person, in my first book. So yeah, it's weird to think about 2016 and like it in so many ways, it feels like yesterday and so long ago. So
yeah. Yeah. I'm trying to think what 2016, that's post Love, Simon, right?
They were really, really close. Love, Simon, I think came out in 2015, I want to say.
Okay.
But now I'm confused on the book and the movie. I'm not sure which the what years were, but it was in that same.
Oh, because you read the book too then.
Yeah.
Because you've probably always been consuming a lot of this kind of stuff then, huh?
Yeah, well, I didn't actually read a lot of queer YA, ironically, when I was a kid, because there was just so fewer options, which is a great, one of the great like signs of publishing is like there's so many more queer options now, especially for teenagers and younger people.
That's, I cannot imagine what it would have been like to read a book like yours or any like queer YA novel in high school. Like it's.
Yeah. And there were books that were like, there were queer authors writing those books, but because the industry wasn't like a lot of mainstream publishers didn't want to buy those books. Even if they got bought and published, a lot of stores wouldn't, you know, stock them.
Or like public school libraries. Yeah.
For sure. Yeah. So, yeah. So I never want to like imply that there weren't queer authors or queer books, but it was just so much harder to like have access to commercial outlets when, you know, 20, 30 years ago when you're writing about queer YA. So, yeah.
Yeah. But still, so you were writing this book and at that point queer media was just kind of becoming a little bit more mainstream and accepted, but still pretty early on in that. So, it's really cool that that's what made you decide to write it and, that it's gotten to see the light of day in this amazing way.
Yeah. No, it's wild. I know I think it is also worth thinking about this moment in history too, because there's been, you know, if any of your listeners are following like the book bans that have been happening in public schools and public libraries, mostly in red areas of the country, but not exclusively by any means. It's an interesting time to be writing in queer YA because, like I just mentioned, like we've had so many steps forward, which is great, but then we're kind of amid like the backlash of that progress right now. So there's definitely like a push and pull. So it's both exciting to be writing in this space, but also can be a little contentious or not contentious. A little freaky at times.
a little freaky.
Yeah.
a little revolutionary. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, actually, so I'm not super well versed in this. I've maybe heard stuff on the periphery of like book bans here and stuff. I feel like that's always been a thing, right? But maybe not. So kind of catch me up to date. What's been going on with this?
Yeah. So I can't remember if it was 2022 or 23 that had the most, by far the most book bans, in the country since, oh my gosh, like I think a century or something. Fact check me, any listeners, after this, but, there was just a huge, huge spike in books being banned.
We love spreading misinformation on the pod.
Yes. No, we don't do that.
No.
And it was mostly just because of this, you know, right-wing pushback to, you know, wokeism and all of that, you know, eye-rolly stuff where I think when we experience like true progress in, you know, amplifying marginalized voices and stuff, there is that pushback from certain political leaders. So a lot of the book bans that have been taking place have been at the state level or the local level. There hasn't been any like big pieces of federal legislation cracking down on books, but like in Florida, there's the Don't Say Gay bill that, isn't directly related to books specifically, but it does affect textbooks in the state because, gay teachers are really, afraid to come out with their queerness or to be teaching anything that involves LGBTQ history because it can be penalized in the state of Florida. And there's lots of other states and areas of the country that, have similar bans or are trying to put similar bans in place. So good times.
Yeah.
Great times.
Have there any, what's like the latest on that? Have there been any developments? Is there anything happening to slow down these book bans? Is this having a major impact on your sales?
Not me specifically, which is great. It's sort of strange. There's like a handful of authors who, for a variety of reasons, their book is sort of like, kind of becomes the, like, the poster child of like, oh, this book is so inappropriate. We shouldn't be, you know, like putting these books in libraries or whatever. And so there's a handful of queer authors who've been like targeted and hit most by it. I fortunately haven't been one of them. But yeah, in terms of the latest developments, it kind of depends on the state and the city. I don't know like the specific updates, but, yeah, I think that's why we got to vote. We got to vote for candidates who are not going to ban books.
Do you know, is your book banned?
I haven't gotten her. So I've seen, like, on social media, it's been on a few lists where, like, people have tagged me and stuff where it's, like, and I truly can't even remember, like, where this was. But it was on a list of, like, a ton of other queer books about, like being flagged or something for, like, a city council thing. Like, it was very local thing. But I haven't gotten any confirmation that there's been an actual banning of the book. But the weird thing is it's a lot of the time, because it's, we say book bans, but a lot of the time it's more of like a chilling effect where just because it, like, if one, like, state bans it, now every state is, like, librarians in every state are going to be more cautious about, like, what books they're choosing to put in their library just because, you know, they know they might get backlash. And that's no shade against librarians. Librarians are amazing. But there is just, there's more pressure on educators, teachers, librarians to just, yeah, like, not ruffle feathers. And so I feel for them because they know that they'll get hit with a lot of hate. So
interesting. Yeah. So even if your book specifically doesn't get banned, just the book banning stuff in general could be impacting what's happening with you. And
yeah.
And then even if your book gets banned in Wyoming, that could affect its reception across the nation for that reason. That's
Really, and not even like
no shade to Wyoming. I just threw out a random state.
No shade to Wyoming. Screw it. No. And it's not even like, it's more about the genre as a whole. I think that not necessarily like my book specifically, but just as a whole, the chilling effect affects more. Especially marginalized BIPOC authors, trans authors. You know, I think I've gotten probably pretty lucky because I'm a white cisgender gay, and it's probably a lot worse for, you know, like a black trans woman, you know? So, yeah.
Wow. Well, that's really fascinating. Yeah, thank you so much for sharing. Dark.
Sorry.
Oh my God. No, we were here to talk about ideas.
Can I wipe this? Oh, you have tissues.
We're about to go watch the. Okay. Yeah.
Sorry. These lights.
Oh, yeah. So while Robbie dries off,
I got a good towel.
Let's read the book. Woo!
Sky is an openly gay high school student living with his best friend Bree after his single mom kicked him out for being gay. Sky has a crush on his classmate Ali, and his plans to ask him to prom are exposed to the school by an email blast, calling Sky and Ali the F-slur. Sky's friends Marshall, Bree, Dan, and Marshall's friend Teddy rush to Sky's aid, and they recruit students from the yearbook community, led by Mrs. Widgers, to even make sure it's celebrating gay love. An anonymous tip points Sky to Charlie, a gay man who Sky learns used to be best friends with his father before he passed. Sky grows more comfortable in his own skin in his own hometown, learns he received a scholarship from community college, and is asked to prom by Teddy.
And we're back. Woo! All right, so it's 2024 now, 3 years later. What's it like thinking about revisiting, you know, just this book in general with all the time and space you've had with it?
Ooh, that's a good question. It's interesting because I've been in like press mode for another first chance. And so I haven't really talked about Sky that often. So even like just thinking about this podcast coming in today, it was nice to kind of revisit it. Cause I think we kind of briefly talked about this before we started recording, where, I think any author or any writer, artist in general, probably has moments where they hate their work or think it's like the worst book ever. And then the next day it's like, no, this is a masterpiece. And then you have like every single emotion on that spectrum between those two things. And for Sky, I feel like I'm at a place now where it's been so long that it's really nice to like think about the book again and think about the characters and kind of go back into that space. Cause it's just been a minute since I've been there. Yeah. So I love the book so much.
Yeah. And it is a really feel good book too, especially when you're talking about a book that deals so heavily with grief. Obviously Sky has a lot of his own struggles, mm-hmm. but at the end of the day, it's a pretty warm feeling book together. Yeah. You know, it's like a nice comforting cozy read. So
yeah.
What a nice thing to have in this world. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. There's definitely, sadder, more tragic elements to it, but that's, I wanted the book to leave readers feeling hopeful and if there are any tears, hopefully happy tears. Don't know if you can say the same for my fourth book, but Sky is definitely hopefully a feel good.
Yeah.
Book. Yeah.
Well, what really stood out to me, and I didn't realize this until I was reading it, is like, oh my gosh, I don't know that I've ever read a book with someone who is openly gay, with a high school character who's openly gay, because Sky starts the book being out to the whole high school, basically, right?
Right, yeah. So it's not a coming out story, but because he's relatively new to being out, he's still, you know, kind of moving through the world in a little bit cautious way, or just kind of very aware of, you know, how, like, towards the beginning of the book, you know, there's a scene where he's very in his head about, you know, making sure he's carrying his books the quote unquote right way, or like
dear hips
books.
Dear hips swish, Robbie.
I mean, maybe they do, maybe they don't. I haven't thought about my walk in a minute, but but I do remember and relate to high school Robbie just being really in my own head about like not coming across as gay, or like those two things specifically, like the way I walk, the way I held my textbooks in the hallway, like those just very small things that can look queer coded or whatever. I was so in my own head about that. So Sky is definitely living in that world. Even though he's out, he's still trying to get comfortable with it. So yeah.
Yeah. When you were, as you said, closeted in high school, right?
I was.
When did you come out?
My freshman year of college.
Hey, me too.
Yeah. Nice. At UT.
Me at UT, okay, yeah. Were you at U of M? Oh, Michigan State. State. Yeah. Oh, my dad was U of M, so.
Great school. Ann Arbor's awesome. The school, whatever. But I came out my freshman year. It was like the very stereotypical thing of like moved away, came back for like Christmas break or whatever, came out to my family. They're like, wow, college really turned my son gay. They didn't say that. But yeah, it's weird because a part of me does wish I was able to come out in high school and have that experience. But at the same time, I just don't think I was ready, you know? And I think every queer person as like, I want to encourage every young queer person to come out. But at the same time, you have to do it on your time and when you're comfortable and when it makes sense for you. So for me, that was my freshman year.
While we're on this quick tangent, I'll point out, especially if there's anyone listening who hasn't come out, for me, I came out my freshman year of college, and what was really nice, because I'd been so in the closet for so long, I have had trouble even saying the words I'm gay. Like,
for
it was
sure. Yeah.
Very, so even though I'd always planned to come out in college, it still took me a couple weeks before I did. And what helped is I met a group of queer people that my friend, I just sat with a friend and she ended up being in a group of queer people, and they were talking about this thing called coffee or hangout. The organization was called Hangout, and they had this event called Coffee, and it was basically somewhere I could go and just like meet a bunch of other gay people that were in my college or around the area. And it was like, you know, not an alcoholic event, not a hookup app, not a, you know, there was just so many factors of it that were such a nice, healthy way for me to have my first experience being openly gay and meeting other gay people. So I would highly encourage anyone who is coming out to seek a group like that, because I think there's also a lot of, maybe maladaptive is a strong way to say it, but a lot of ways that people end up coming out where I think it's not as healthy, right? You're like immediately thrown into this environment where everyone's maybe looking for sex or something, and it's nice to have something where there is no expectations and you can just meet people.
Yeah, for sure. I think like it's, there definitely needs to be more spaces like that, because historically speaking, like queer spaces were bars and they were often underground because they didn't want to deal with police or whatever. So then it sort of forced people to either kind of accept that those environments are the sort of environments where they could be queer, or they would just stay in the closet. So it's great now that there's like all of these other ways, and there should be more, to be able to like meet queer people and engage in the community without just having to get trashed at you know, at High Tops on a Friday night. But at the same time, it's like I don't want to like shame anyone for drinking, or like I'm like a very sex positive person, so I don't if that floats your boat as a young person, that's great. But I just think everyone should be able to have the options to come out in whatever space feels, you know, right for them. So
yeah, really well said. Okay, so I asked you about what it's like reflecting in the past. Now imagine a movie's been made about this, and now people who have seen the movie are coming back to see you talking about this. That's kind of the headspace I think is really interesting to think about. So this can be a cool time capsule for when the movie does come out. So first of all, what can you tell us about the movie? I know some stuff's already been announced.
So it's still, as you probably know, there's so many steps to getting a movie made. So, it's still like pre-production, I guess would be the most official term for where it's at. They have a director who's incredible. Michael Medico he's done a lot of work in TV. He's directed, like Grey's Anatomy episodes. He's done Atypical on Netflix. He's done a lot of Ryan Murphy projects. And when I met him, he was just so, like, his vision for the film was just so great. I'm so excited. Cause of course there's changes, like there are going to be changes. But the changes that were sort of proposed, I felt like it made sense for the medium, right? Because it's just a visual medium. So of course it's going to, you know, take a different approach to tell the same story. But, there's a script in the works, which I think I can say the script is almost finalized, or it might be finalized by now. And so they're doing a lot of other stuff behind the scenes, like casting and getting the right people in the right places. But yeah, I hope it's on a screen someday. We'll see if that actually happens. But,
oh, interesting. Yeah. 'Cause there's a chance it could never see the light of day.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, there's, like I said, so many steps to getting it officially greenlit. So it's still in pre-production. So I hope it happens. And a lot of the signs that I've been seeing are very optimistic to it getting made, but we'll see.
Okay.
Yeah.
How did this even come about? Let's start with when you were writing the book. Did you have in mind, how could I write this to make it more appealing to be made into a movie? Like, did that cross your mind at all? Or were you just like, this is a book and I'm not even going to worry about what it would look like on screen?
Yeah, I didn't at all, because I think sometimes there are some authors that do that, especially if you're a successful author, because there's some authors that have the reputation, the success under their belt, where every book they made, there's going to be interest in, like, okay, you know, who's optioning it, whatever. So I think sometimes authors who are already in that space where a lot of their work has been adapted may kind of be thinking first about, like, okay, will this translate to a screen, or like, how can I make sure it does? I didn't with my first book, just because I wrote it before I was repped, before I had an agent, before I had a publisher. And so just the fact that I even got it published at that point, I was like, oh my God, this is incredible. So the idea that I would be like already writing it, writing the movie version of it, was just like so beyond like where my head was at back in 2016, 17. So, I didn't write it with that intent, but I think a lot of people were able to kind of see it through a cinematic lens, which was really cool. I hope it is a movie.
Yeah. I mean, that speaks well of your work. 'Cause even if you're not writing with the idea of screen, it's still like, very important to have imagery and like description. And yeah, I think it is very easy to see as I'm reading it, like, oh, okay. Yeah. I can see what this looks like, which is really cool. Good. I won't make you spoil any of them, but I am very curious to see what the changes
in the script are going to be. Have you, did they, were you involved in the writing of the script?
Not in the writing itself, but I'm a consultant on the film. So the scriptwriters and the director and the team at Walden have been so great in like looping me in on stuff and making sure I don't have any like formal approval process, but I'm still a voice in the room a lot of the times, which has been great. And yeah, they've been awesome. So I know like, I don't want to be like that annoying author that's always like, hey, how's it go? Like, what changes have you made? Because I don't want to annoy the crap out of all of them, but I'm, of course, always so curious. So yeah, I'm sure there's a lot that I don't know and I just get like the biggest updates, but, yeah. Did that answer your question?
Yeah. Okay. So my second question then is, okay, so book's been published and did you, was at some point, did you and your agents or whatever talk about like, okay, how can we pitch this to be made into a movie? Or was this something that just like fell into your lap when you were like, oh.
Yeah. So they had, and this was all stuff I learned too. Cause my first book, I was like, what's an agent? What's a movie? Like I had no idea. But, so a lot of times when you're published through or like, okay, backing up a second. If you have an agent, a lot of times, or at least sometimes, that agency has different agency partners that then rep. This is getting so into the weeds. I hope I'm not like boring.
No. I think this is actually like what I'm interested in, and hopefully what my listeners are interested in too, right? Because this is all about how can we help more queer media get into the world. So all these steps are so important and very interesting. Like this behind the scenes of how
nerds
this
listening.
Happening.
I love it.
Yes, I'm a nerd too. I have nothing if not a nerd.
So basically, there's a really terrific person at Gersh who represents my books, and so
Gersh is
an agency, a film, TV, media company agency. So there's folks that are agents at Gersh who then will like pitch the book to studios or different talent or kind of be the go-between to getting an option.
And so how did you get connected with Gersh in the first place?
Yeah, so the rep at Gersh is associated through my literary agent, like the agency itself.
Got it.
Individually, like independently repped by Gersh. Gersh like works through Bookends, my literary agency. Sorry if that's confusing.
Got it.
Yeah. So then that rep, I don't want to say her name just because I don't know if she...
That's fine. Yeah.
If she wants another. But so then she was the person that was pitching and handling a lot of that.
And you knew this. You knew that your book was being pitched.
For sure. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, because there's a whole conversation around like, are there any people you want involved? Or like any people you want to be a priority to be pitched to? And so there's conversations like that. But then all of the work goes on to the agent, thank God, because I would not know what I'm doing.
Was that a discussion that you were looped in on then of like, were you approached by your agent being like, hey, what would you think if we tried to pitch this as a movie?
Yeah. So they, I'm trying to remember like the initial conversations. I think there were, cause I don't know what author would be like, no, let's make sure there's no adaptation for my book. So I don't even know if there was like a formal ask or if it was just more of like, we're pitching your book.
I mean, that's so like, exciting. Like what an exciting like idea to even conceive. Yeah.
Yeah. No, when I found out anyone was interested in optioning it, I was just like, holy, like pinch me. Going back to what I was just talking about, like it was a goal to write a book by 30, right? Is that math checkout? Yeah. It was by my 30th birthday. And
congrats.
Yeah. Or I decided I wanted to write it. I'm confusing myself, but and just the fact that it got published, I was already like on cloud nine. So the fact that anyone was interested in putting it on a screen someday was just, it still kind of blows my mind.
It's a pretty quick turnaround time to like, yeah, you've done a lot in the past 3 years. Yeah.
Hustling. Yeah. And I was just writing book 5 before I came over here. So.
Oh, really? You're working on book 5?
Yeah.
Oh, that's exciting.
The first draft's done. I'm working on revisions now. It's a hot mess right now, but it's going to be good.
Wow, you stay working. That's crazy.
Yeah. Well, they, especially in the young adult genre, because it's younger readers who potentially age out quicker. They like, as opposed to like adult fiction, they like authors who write a lot just because they want to get a lot of books out of
here. Interesting. Yeah. It's like, if you want to be able to like reach your target demographic, oh, they like a book by Robbie Couch, maybe they'll like another one. It's like, well, they won't if they're 3 years older. get writing now.
Exactly. Which is not to say adults don't read YA, because a ton of, like, at my events and stuff, a lot of the readers are adults.
I see the logic for sure.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, your book's being pitched, and then, can you explain what optioning means in this context?
Yes. Because I did not know what optioning meant when I first heard the word. When your book gets optioned, that essentially means a media company is buying the right, or like renting the rights basically of that IP, intellectual property of the story. So, in the case of The Sky Blues, Walden Media optioned Sky. So they, have, and every option is, like a different amount of time. Usually they're like a year, 18 months. And so basically the media company has control of the rights for that amount of time. And then they can either decide to, purchase the film, meaning then it kind of gets greenlit and becomes official. Or they can, re-sign your option, which essentially means you just get a bit more money. They can extend the option longer. Or they can pass on it, which happens a lot. Like a lot of work gets optioned that never gets made, which is, a thing that a lot of people I don't think realize in Hollywood, like how many things get optioned. Mm. And then there's slowly that funnel down to like what actually gets produced. So, lots of steps.
But it sounds like you're, cause I imagine some stuff gets optioned and then they don't even write a script for it, right? Like your story could just be optioned and doing nothing, but they're actively doing a lot with it right now.
Yeah. I'm always surprised. I'm like, oh yeah, it's still happening. This isn't a dream.
Yeah.
Like I said, they got the director, they got a script. I know they're working. There's a lot happening behind the scenes. So, I'm optimistic, but I'm trying not to get too excited because then I'll have my heart broken. So.
Okay. But this is still a really interesting point to talk to you then in this stage of like, and so are you just, out of curiosity, are you trying to, do you know, are your other books being pitched in a similar matter?
So If I See You Again Tomorrow is my third book. That's the Time Loop Groundhog's Day. That book, there's a lot of updates there, but I can't say any of them. So that's happening, for my third book.
Okay.
And then my fourth book, they should be pitching it, cause they usually will pitch it, like right after the release or around the release when there's like some buzz around it and stuff. So we're in the process now of pitching another first chance out there. So.
Wow. That's exciting.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, it's also wild that like you are, just currently, you have just released a book. So you're doing the press for that. You're consulting on your first book being made into a movie, and you're working on your fifth book. You have a lot going on. I mean, this is your full-time job, right? This is what a joy. Job.
Yeah. And to be like the consulting on the movie is not definitely nowhere near full-time, but it is, it is one of the things that I'm focused on.
Yeah. It's another thing to have. I mean, I could imagine someone having to spend all their time on just that. So the fact that you're doing so much right now is amazing.
Yeah.
So let's go back to The Sky Blues. Talk me through how you found out it was getting published, everything, and like what came from there. Cause it sounds like a lot of stuff fell into place immediately following the publishing of the book.
Yeah. So I remember when I first got, when I got a call from my agent, who wasn't my agent at the time, I was pitching my agents, potential agents, getting the phone call from Mo, who's my agent. Just seeing that it was her on the phone, like calling me, that had to be good news. So I remember just freaking out, answering it, was so overwhelmed that I made up a lie. I think I told, if you're listening to this, I think I told you this, but if not, then I'm sorry, but was so overwhelmed that I just hung up on her. Well, I was like, oh, I have to call you back. I'm at work. I like rushed. I like said something really quickly and she was like, okay. And then I hung up on her. Calmed myself the F down and then called her back and was like, I'm sorry, I'm at work. I just like lied about being busy at work because I just couldn't even like have that conversation because I was so excited.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was when I got repped. And then, my book went to the Sky Blues went to auction, which means there was more than one publisher who was interested in it. And when I got that news, that was really, really cool. Cause you're just, I'm just like praying for anyone to be interested at all. And so for more than one to be interested was really, really cool. So yeah, that was also like a freak out moment for sure.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was cool.
Okay. So I didn't realize then you got the agent first and that's how you got the book. Okay, cool.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was your literary agent. Or sorry, is that what it's called?
Yeah. Literary
agent. And then do you have additional, you said you have a manager now that came next. How did that all work?
Well, I don't have a manager. Are you talking about Gersh?
Oh, okay. I was wondering who else is involved now? What else did you get connected with, like, from the book?
Yeah, so I have my literary agent and then the person at Gersh doing the adaptation stuff. And then I have a publicist. Through my publisher, I work with an editor and, like, their own publicity team.
You have a publicist. Is that connected to your agent or your publisher, or is this, like, a separate thing?
A separate thing, yeah. That's...
Really?
Yeah, that's not through the others.
Did you seek out this publicist? Did you hire them?
They came to me. They were interested in repping me. So, yeah.
That's really cool. I didn't even know that was a thing, that you could have your own publicist.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. You can... It's LA, baby. You can have anything you want. That's so gross. But, yeah. No, I have a publicist. Yeah. Even saying that, I feel... I'm like, I have a publicist.
Well, it's important for people to know. Maybe someone wants to get a publicist.
Yeah.
Like, right?
And Jeff is great. Jeff's a great publicist.
What services does he, like, provide for you?
Really just like any sort of like, media inquiries that I get to do press like this, we met each other. So that was not through my publicist, but, and then just looking for opportunities where, you know, cause the reason why I really liked this publicist was because he really seemed to genuinely want to have more queer stories out in the world. He liked my voice and my work. And so it felt, and just the fact that he believed in me so early on in my career was cool. So he's just always looking for ways to get either me and or my books in the spotlight. So
that's amazing.
Yeah.
What were you doing before your book came out?
I worked in I did a lot of different things. I majored in journalism in school. So after college, I interned at the Oprah magazine for a minute, which was very wild. And then I worked at HuffPost as a writer and worked for a website called Upworthy. So I did a lot of like human interest and, like feature pieces and sort of a lot of queer stuff too at Upworthy, not so much at HuffPost, but, so I did
that's
that
really cool, actually.
Yeah.
So you're still able to make a career out of writing even before you were published.
Yeah. But I kind of hit that wall where I was like, I want something else. I want to do more.
It's a pretty fiction. Big step.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
That's wild. Mm-hmm. So as I said, for me, this is the first book I've read that had that center, you know, even first story really, which is wild to think about. Cause you have Heartstopper, which centers around a main character who's been recently outed. Mm-hmm. But even then that was pretty recent. And a lot of the story still centers around a relationship with someone who's not out. Which I guess to a degree yours does too, but the love interest in your book doesn't really seem to struggle with it as much. You know, at least that's not a side of the story we see, I should say.
Yeah.
It's really not about the struggle of coming out in many ways at all. Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess you do see bits of his past, right? That were the ramifications of him coming out.
Right.
And I'm trying to think of other, and I really, I'm drawing a blank. I mean, for me, this is a huge, like, missed or a previously missed niche, right? Of like, how have we not had a story like this yet? It seems so obvious, right? Yeah. Let's talk about a kid in high school who's already out. So I guess I wanted to ask you, is that something you had noticed too? Or are there comps that I'm missing where you're like, oh, actually, I'd been inspired by this book or that book or, yeah.
Yeah. No, so Queer YA is newer in publishing, like in terms of like the broad spectrum of history, like I would say probably in the past like decade or so, or maybe two decades, there's been many more queer authors and queer books. And my, like, the Sky Blues is as flattered and honored as I am to hear you say that. Definitely not the first. There was so many books that came before me. who were like blazing trails, and maybe we weren't recording when I mentioned this, but there's always been like queer authors, obviously, and queer books, but I think a lot of it was lack of opportunity or access to get on a shelf in Barnes and Noble or get on Amazon or whatever the equivalent of Amazon was 30 years ago, an actual bookstore. So even though those creators and writers were like getting, trying to write their stories, they just didn't have the same privileges and opportunities that I have. I think I guess you could say Sky was in like maybe the first wave of like, or first or second wave of like a big queer YA books, or not that the book was big, but just, you know, a big wave of queer books.
Yeah.
But there were so many authors that have been blazing trails before me. So yeah, but thank you.
Did you have any comps you used when writing this book?
Oh my gosh. See, this is, I don't even remember the comps we used when I was pitching it, or like
did you have any mentor texts when you were writing the book?
What text?
Mentor texts?
What is that? Is that a film thing?
No, as a term I learned from my mom, who's a children's book author.
Oh, maybe they should know it.
Maybe it is a children's book author, but basically it's the idea of like, something you're trying to write a children's book. You might look at what are the like biggest children's books out right now, and kind of like read them and get a feel for what the vibe is, right?
Or right.
And
then you would say like, oh, this book is like The Little Mermaid meets Lion King, or what? Like,
well, that's a comp, right? I mean, more like when you're writing something, or when you're developing something, and you're like, okay, how do I do this and do it well? Well, let's see. I liked this book. Why did I like it? What are they doing?
Gotcha. So it's more of like an internal process.
Work on it. Yeah.
Okay. Learn everything, or learn something new every day. Probably should know that.
I'm also not entirely sure that my mom didn't make it up, so but we love spreading misinformation on the pod.
Look, I'm four books in and I'm still like learning a term that like every other author in the room has heard a million times. I'm like, what does that mean? So when I wrote it, that was when Love, Simon was just coming out, and I forgot when Love, Simon was published, because the book and the movie were within a few years. I think it was 2015, could be off. So that was something that was one of the first big breakout queer stories, I think, in the space that like got a film deal and all that. So that was an inspiration. Adam Silvera, who's my friend, has been such an inspiration. He's
okay, flex.
Yeah, he's my friend. They Both Die at the End has been a huge book, and I read More Happy Than Not back in 20-something, and that was a big inspiration. Reading his first book was the first book that I read that had a queer teen protagonist, and so that...
What book is this?
More Happy Than Not. That was his first book. So that was a big deal for me, because I was like, oh, people are doing this and they're writing really great stories and stories that are getting published and selling, and maybe I can do it too. So, yeah.
Oh, that's so, oh my God, that's so inspirational. Like, you see people doing it, like, oh, it can be done. Ugh.
Right.
I love that.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
But, and just going back to like what else is out there, is there any, do you know of any films or movies or TV shows that center around an openly gay character? I'm just saying, I don't think I do. So I'm hoping this gets made, because I think there's an unmet need in the market for it.
There's like you mentioned Heartstopper and Love, Victor is like the series from
Love, Simon.
There's definitely I know of a lot that are like in the adaptation process right now, that I don't know if it's like been announced for other people, so I don't know who I can name, but
that's so funny.
Yeah, but there are other books and series. A lot of like fantasy series are really big in YA too, so a lot of those get adapted for different streamers. So yeah, there's definitely been a lot of trailblazers in the space recently.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
So you talking about Love, Victor made me think of, I love that first scene that first episode where he's like getting the letter back from Simon. And I always love queer mentors. It always like really, for whatever reason, it really strikes a chord with me. And maybe it's because I didn't have one growing up, and so whenever I see that, I'm like, oh, that's beautiful, you know.
Yeah,
as I said, I got to meet my queer mentors in college, kind of just like people who'd been out longer than me. But that's why Charles, like, I love that character so much. Yeah. Oh, I'm getting teary just thinking about it. It's really, really beautifully set up when where he visits and he sees the rainbow lapel and
yeah.
Sorry, I'm crying on the podcast.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. Your book did evoke a lot of emotion from me. I want to let you know that. Yeah.
Thank you. I don't want to see you cry, but that means a
lot.
No.
A lot of them were happy tears or soulful tears or healing tears. It was really nice. There's a lot of great moments in your book.
Thank you.
So how did the idea for that character come
up?
Yeah.
Okay. That's testing my memory bank.
Or just not even more broadly than that. Did you have any queer mentors like that growing up or anyone that you think of?
I actually didn't in my immediate, like, small town. And this is what's sort of tricky is, like, I think there were allies for sure, like teachers, coaches, whoever, adults in my small Michigan town. But I think back then, not to age myself, but I graduated high school in 2007. And again, lived in, like, a, you know, smaller, overwhelmingly white Rust Belt town in the Midwest. So there weren't that many, really any out openly queer adults at the school. And if there were, and it was like it would just be kind of understood that they were queer, but they couldn't really like I saw zero rainbow flags in classroom at school. So I didn't really, and when I wrote the book, that was one of the themes that I wanted to have in the book was that, you know, Sky starts out in the book feeling like, you know, he hates his hometown. He can't wait to escape it. There's so much homophobia, transphobia, and all of that is real and valid. But by the end of the book, he also discovers the number of people who are standing up for him, who are going to fight for him, whether it's adults and teachers in the community or other students at the school. So sometimes I think in some areas of the country, it's really easy to feel like everyone has a MAGA hat on or whatever, whatever it is. And I think we have to remember that a lot of the fiercest allies are out there. Sometimes it's just harder to find them or spot them, but they're there. So, yeah.
Yeah. It felt like you really hit the right tone of a realism on both sides of how, like, there are people that were really bad bullies and there are people that are, but even the bullies felt real in their own way, you know, because sometimes you see bullying in high school and it's like being shoved against the locker and being given swirlies, but really just kind of like the classroom antagonism.
Yeah.
It's harder for teachers to stop it. It's more insidious.
Right.
And you have that in your book. But also you do a good job of showing like the good people. It feels realistic. Yeah. It's not like, oh, everyone's just turned their back on him and stuff
right,
like that. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, without giving too much away. Yeah, by the end, I think Sky really has some eye-opening moments of like, oh, yeah, there's lots of people that have...
We can do spoilers in this section.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, we can do spoilers. That's right. I mean, yeah, not even that I was thinking of a specific spoiler. But yes, by the end of it, Sky definitely feels like, oh, yeah, there are people that have my back. And he's able to, you know, he stays in Rockledge and goes to community college. And I think that was something else that was sort of important that, you know, he has friends that have moved away to school and that's sort of sad to say goodbye to them. But at the same time, you know, and not that the book goes into college or anything, but it's good to know that Sky feels safe and supported staying in Rockledge after high school. Even though at the beginning of the book, that was a much bigger question mark. So, yeah.
Yeah. Another character I really want to highlight is Dan, the trans character, which especially it sounds like when you're writing this, trans characters were very uncommon. And I myself haven't seen, I still remember seeing my first trans man on Survivor. And that was my first time even like seeing one. Right. Mm-hmm. So what made you decide to include a trans character in your book? And I think it's, first of all, I think it's an amazing choice. I really love the character. I love the discussion it kind of brings up, that you get to see through Sky's point of view.
Yeah.
But yeah, I wanted to ask you about that.
Yeah. Well, I definitely wanted, I think Dan's character was sort of a part of a sort of similar theme with, Marshall, who is a black kid in an overwhelmingly white school. I wanted Sky to kind of be able to have his own like privilege checked, or not even checked, but just like made aware of the different experiences. Cause I think he sort of starts out in a place where he, not that he's like playing the victim card, but it can feel kind of like, oh yeah, this town hates me. The world is against me. And then I think having characters like Dan, who is trans and deals with transphobia in different ways that Sky can't relate to. And Marshall, who's a black kid and has a different dynamic with, like, for instance, the local police or whatever. I think Sky's experience in, like, having those conversations with those characters, I think really helped him to open his eyes and kind of just be made aware of the bigger world outside of his own brain. And that was sort of important to me, to have his own little moments of, yeah, revelatory moments in his own brain. So yeah,
I love that. So it's not just representation for the sake of representation. It actually, for you, fit a really key part of the narrative and of this character's, or the main character's, growth.
I think representation has to do that, because I feel like whenever you read a book or see a movie that's like, just feels like it's checking off diversity boxes, it's like, who's that for? Like, no, like, I think when you can, I think the whole value of representation is making it valuable to the story, right? And then it's almost like the representation comes second to the quality of the story, but then it's more powerful because it's a great story with great characters. So
I think it really does build the narrative strong. Did you I guess a couple questions. One, did you have characters in your real life that inspired, like, Marshall and or Dan? And two, did you have any, I'm sure you had a sensitivity reader or something, but, like, how did you go about making sure that you were handling those issues? Because I think you handled them well, obviously, but obviously I'm a white cis gay man,
you. So you're not the voice of authority. But thank you, regardless. So the first question, I've never had a character actually where I'm like, oh, this character is specifically inspired by this person. It's always sort of like a mishmash of different experiences and people I've met, and like, I kind of, they're all kind of Frankenstein monsters of all the different people I've met. Like Miss Winter, I kind of drew from like a few different teachers that really meant a lot to me, that kind of shaped who I wanted Miss Winter to be in the classroom, and being such a badass and an ally. And then, yeah, in terms of authenticity readers, yeah, I had authenticity readers. I've had authenticity readers for all of my books, because I just want to make sure that I'm not unintentionally doing any harm with writing any other marginalized characters. And it's weird, because I think there's can be sometimes this, like, almost antagonistic relationship between authors and sensitivity readers, or there's like a perception that there is, but from my experience and from most of the authors I've spoken to with readers, it's like they're on your team. Like, they want to make the book as best as it can be, you know? So it's like when they're giving you feedback about, you know, this potential flag, or like, oh, a black reader might interpret this way in a way that would never be on my radar. You know, that sort of stuff was really, really valuable. So I highly recommend sensitivity readers, authenticity readers for all your work, if you're writing about a character that has a very different lived experience than your own.
That's very good. Just communication is actually a pretty big theme in this book too, because Mrs. Winter's whole thing of, like, fight to keep your friends.
Right.
Yeah,
for sure.
There's so much depth with her. You want to know more.
So I've gotten the question, you're like, could you write a sequel, or any plans for a sequel? And potentially, for sure. But I think if I had the choice, I would write actually a prequel, because there's a lot of backstory with Miss Winter and Sky's dad. And so I think that's really fertile ground to, like, play with, because I didn't like fully flesh out the pre-story leading up to Sky, but I had some pretty clear ideas of, like, what happened, and so I think it would be really fun to write The Winter Blues. And
you have me intrigued. Oh my god. Yeah.
So I mean, there's no, like, plan for that to happen.
Yeah.
But it would, maybe someday it'd be pretty cool.
When you get bored of book number 5 and 6 and 7 and 8 and 9 and right. 10 or whatever the heck you're churning out these days.
Yeah, when I'm completely out of new ideas, I'll be like, all right, what books can I revisit? So, yeah.
No, I think it's more than just a bottom of the barrel idea. I think it's a great idea.
Thank you.
I have one, I probably,
probably almost done, but I have like one or two more.
I'm just impressed you're not looking at, or are you looking at questions? Because I, whenever I've interviewed someone, I'm like, I have to have all the questions written out.
Most of this I'm making up on the fly, just kind of as I'm inspired and thinking about the book or what resonated with me. And there was one thing that I was like, oh yeah, I want to ask about that or highlight that. This is the one. So you also tackle, what's really cool about this not being a coming out story is it allows you to tackle so many other issues that a queer kid might deal with. And they still have, obviously, all the struggle that comes with being queer, but it's not like, oh, this is a struggle. It's like you have to still handle all your other problems in life through that lens. And so what's interesting is, you know, this is not a star student. This is a student who skips class sometimes, doesn't always get good grades. He's worried about finances and getting into community college. And I guess what made you want to tackle that issues and kind of like what issues were you meaning to tackle with this book? Yeah.
In like the coming out specifically?
No. So you're not doing coming out, but I guess the main one I wanted to point out was like the financial issues. I think it's interesting to highlight that. And on top of that, like a kid's aspirations to get into community college, you don't see that a lot. Where getting into community college was such a huge win for him. And as the reader, I felt it. I was like, oh my God, I'm so happy. He gets to go to community college. It's really great.
Yeah. I mean, I think especially with like the cost of college today, it's becoming, so unaffordable for so many families, kids. And so I wanted to make sure that I think there's enough stories about, you know, rich kids in the suburbs, and no offense against rich kids in the suburbs. Some of my books take place in the suburbs, but I think with Sky, I wanted it to be really zeroed in and tapped into that, like, you know, small town, working class, blue collar, Northern Michigan, where the idea of going to, well, the Ivy League is like completely out of the question. Not even because kids aren't smart, of course. It's just like the finances, the access, all of the everything else that goes into it. But growing up, even going to Michigan State, you know, I grew up in a small town in Michigan, and Michigan State seemed like a huge win for me in my town, because it was like, you could probably count on like two hands the number of kids that went to like a Big Ten school. I think and I think a lot of areas of the country, that's definitely real. Like if you are going to college, if you have enough money to go to college, you're probably either going to community college or, you know, some state school that's less expensive. And I just felt like that was way more authentic to Sky's experience and most kids in a town like Rockledge. So I folded it into the narrative.
Nice. Now, it's been a few years since this book has come out. Mm-hmm. Have you had people reach out? People been like, it was very cool to see Michigan represented, or it was really cool to see like an openly gay kid represented. You know, have you had, what are some of the things people have reached out to comment on or say to you?
Yeah, for sure. It was interesting too, because Sky Blues debuted during the pandemic. So I didn't have any, I didn't meet any readers in person. I had like online events, Zoom events and stuff. Same with Blame for the Wind, my second book. And so by the time If I See You Again Tomorrow came out, my third book, I finally got to meet readers in person on tour and at book festivals and stuff. And it was really, really awesome. Getting their feedback and a lot of like queer representation, people being happy about that. I think it's really cool too, to have older adults. Like obviously I'm writing, you know, queer lit for kids. And so, having it resonate with teenagers is like the number one priority. But it's been a really great surprise having like men in there and women, but it's probably been predominantly men with Sky Blues, like men in their like 50s, 60s and up, like being like, you know, they'll sometimes be very almost like embarrassed by saying like, I mean, I know it's like a book for teenagers, but I loved it. You know, I didn't have these books when I was in high school. I can't believe like this sort of book exists. And that's really, really cool to like feel like I'm a part of something much bigger than me in terms of like contributing to, more queer stories for people who really like laid the groundwork to get to where we are today, where I could write a book like this. So that's been really, really special. And that's been cool.
That's amazing. I'm so happy to hear that. That's so cool. Yeah.
Thanks.
Well, we'll wrap up here. I'm going to give some of my final thoughts, and then I'll probably ask you either your final thoughts and maybe one last question here. So
final thoughts on the book? I think it's a really good read. I think it surprised me in many ways. I thought it was pretty unpredictable. And but then the way it all wrapped up, I was like, oh, everything makes sense. I haven't even talked about the Teddy promposal. Oh, I'm getting teary thinking of that too. And how Marshall was planning that was actually helping him. Oh.
Oh yeah, that was gosh. Fun. And that was a fun thing to write and to figure out. Yeah.
It's an amazing twist and it's a tearjerker. Oh, and I'm crying now thinking about it. It's really, really great.
Yeah, Marshall's a awesome character. Oh, sorry, not to interrupt.
How dare you interrupt me on my podcast? to praise your own character.
I know. No. It's egotistical.
I loved it. And yeah, there's just really, really great for me to see kind of this story get told. And it wasn't even my experience, you know, I wasn't out in high school, but I really enjoyed seeing it, and I feel like there's so much to learn from these characters and the way that they approach friendship and the importance they put on friendship, and it's really heartwarming and really good. So thank you for putting it out into the world.
Thank you so much for having me. Yeah. Doing this, I'm very flattered, and I love that you love the book.
I'll give you one last question here for our audience as we sign off. Any advice you have for any queer authors or anyone who wants to help get more queer stories out into the world?
Ooh. Yeah, for queer authors, I would say don't be intimidated or afraid if what you want to write about as a queer person, it doesn't already exist. Because I think sometimes this industry can be so intimidating and intense when you feel like you're the first or like are one of the first in writing about X or writing about Y. And I think just because there hasn't been an author or a book that's doing what you want to do, that shouldn't dissuade you. It should be even more of an inspiration because it's like, okay, the world needs this, you know? So I think a lot of times marginalized writers, including queer people, kind of have that feeling of like, man, if I make my main character, you know, a BIPOC trans teen or something, like, is that too niche? Is it not going to relate to people? And yeah, write that book, write the book you want to write. And it'll find its readers. So yeah,
amazing. Thank you so much, Robbie. We really appreciated having you today.
Of course.
And thank you for our audience for tuning in.
Thank you.
Until next time. Goodbye.
Bye.
That's all for this week. If you like the podcast, the best way you can support us is by recommending us to others. You can also subscribe to us and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube by searching Rainbow Room Podcast. You can follow us on Instagram and TikTok at Rainbow Room Podcast and Twitter at Rainbow_Room_. Thanks for listening. See you next week.